have fancied that he would find everything as he left it, even perhaps the corpses in the same places on the floor. And now bare walls, no furniture. It seemed strange. He walked to the window and sat down on the windowsill. There were two workmen, both young fellows, but one much younger than the other. They were papering the walls with a new white paper covered with lilac flowers instead of the old dirty yellow one. Raskolnikov, for some reason, felt horribly annoyed by this. He looked at the new paper with dislike, as though he felt sorry to have it all so changed. The workmen had obviously stayed beyond their time, and now they were hurriedly rolling up their paper and getting ready to go home. They took no notice of Raskolnikov's coming in. They were talking. Raskolnikov folded his arms and listened.
"She comes to me in the morning," said the elder to the younger, "very early, all dressed up. 'Why are you preening and prinking?' says I. 'I am ready to do anything to please you, Tit Vasilich.' That's a way of going on. And she dressed up like a regular fashion book."
"And what is a fashion book?" the younger one asked. He obviously regarded the other as an authority.
"A fashion book is a lot of pictures, colored. And they come to the tailors here every Saturday by post from abroad to show folks how to dress. The male sex as well as the female. They're pictures. The gentlemen are generally wearing fur coats, and for the ladies' fluffles, they're beyond anything you can fancy."
"There's nothing you can't find in Petersburg," the younger cried enthusiastically, "except father and mother. There's everything."
"Except them. There's everything to be found, my boy," the elder declared sententiously.
Raskolnikov got up and walked into the other room where the strong box, the bed, and the chest of drawers had been. The room seemed to him very tiny, without furniture in it. The paper was the same. The paper in the corner showed where the case of icons had stood. He looked at it and went to the window. The elder workman looked at him askance.
"What do you want?"
he asked suddenly. Instead of answering, Raskolnikov went into the passage and pulled the bell. The same bell, the same cracked note. He rang it a second and a third time. He listened and remembered. The hideous and agonizingly fearful sensation he had felt then began to come back more and more vividly. He shuddered at every ring, and it gave him more and more satisfaction.
"Well, what do you want? Who are you?"
the workman shouted, going out to him. Raskolnikov went inside again.
"I want to take a flat," he said. "I am looking round."
"It's not the time to look at rooms at night. And you ought to come up with the porter."
"The floors have been washed. Will they be painted?" Raskolnikov went on. "Is there no blood?"
"What blood?"
"Why, the old woman and her sister were murdered here. There was a perfect pool there."
"But who are you?"
the workman cried, uneasy.
"Who am I?"
"Yes."
"You want to know? Come to the police station, I'll tell you."
The workmen looked at him in amazement.
"It's time for us to go. We're late. Come along, Alyoshka. We must lock up," said the elder workman.
"Very well, come along," said Raskolnikov indifferently, and going out first, he went slowly downstairs.
"Hey, porter!"
he cried in the gateway. At the entrance, several people were standing, staring at the passers-by. The two porters, a peasant woman, a man in a long coat, and a few others. Raskolnikov went straight up to them.
"What do you want?" asked one of the porters.
"Have you been to the police office?"
"I've just been there. What do you want?"
"Is it open?"
"Of course."
"Is the assistant there?"
"He was there for a time. What do you want?"
Raskolnikov made no reply, but stood beside them, lost in thought.
"He's been to look at the flat," said the elder workman, coming forward. "Which flat?"
"Where we are at work. 'Why have you washed away the blood?' says he.
"There has been a murder here," says he, "and I've come to take it." And he began ringing at the bell, all but broke it. "Come to the police station," says he. "I'll tell you everything there." He wouldn't leave us.
The porter looked at Raskolnikov, frowning and perplexed.
"Who are you?"
he shouted as impressively as he could. "I am Rodion Romanovich Raskolnikov, formerly a student. I live in Shil's house, not far from here, flat number 14. Ask the porter, he knows me." Raskolnikov said all this in a lazy, dreamy voice, not turning round, but looking intently into the darkening street.
"Why have you been to the flat?"
"To look at it."
"What is there to look at?" "Take him straight to the police station," the man in the long coat jerked in abruptly. Raskolnikov looked intently at him over his shoulder and said in the same slow, lazy tone,
"Come along."
"Yes, take him," the man went on more confidently. "Why was he going into that? What's in his mind, eh?" "He's not drunk, but God knows what's the matter with him," muttered the workman. "But what do you want?" the porter shouted again, beginning to get angry in earnest. "Why are you hanging about?"
"You're afraid of the police station, then?" said Raskolnikov, jeeringly.
"Afraid of what? Why are you hanging about?" "He's a rogue," shouted the peasant woman. "Why waste time talking to him?" cried the other porter, a huge peasant in a full open coat and with keys on his belt. "Get along! He is a rogue, and no mistake! Get along!"
And seizing Raskolnikov by the shoulder, he flung him into the street. He lurched forward, but recovered his footing, looked at the spectators in silence, and walked away.
"Strange man," observed the workman. "There are strange folks about nowadays," said the woman. "You should have taken him to the police station all the same," said the man in the long coat. "Better have nothing to do with him," decided the big porter. "A regular rogue. Just what he wants, you may be sure, but once take him up, you won't get rid of him. We know the sort."
"Shall I go there or not?" thought Raskolnikov, standing in the middle of the thoroughfare at the crossroads. And he looked about him as though expecting from someone a decisive word. But no sound came. All was dead and silent, like the stones on which he walked. Dead to him alone. All at once, at the end of the street, 200 yards away, in the gathering dusk, he saw a crowd and heard talks and shouts. In the middle of the crowd stood a carriage. A light gleamed in the middle of the street. "What is it?" Raskolnikov turned to the right and went up to the crowd. He seemed to clutch at everything, and smiled coldly when he recognized this. For he had fully made up his mind to go to the police station, and knew that it would all soon be over. Chapter 7. An elegant carriage stood in the middle of the road with a pair of spirited grey horses. There was no one in it, and the coachman had got off his box and stood by. The horses were being held by the bridle. A mass of people had gathered round, the police standing in front. One of them held a lighted lantern which he was turning on something lying close to the wheels. Everyone was talking, shouting, exclaiming. The coachman seemed at a loss and kept repeating, "What a misfortune! Good Lord, what a misfortune!" Raskolnikov pushed his way in as far as he could, and succeeded at last in seeing the object of the commotion and interest. On the ground, a man who had been run over lay apparently unconscious, and covered with blood. He was very badly dressed, but not like a workman. Blood was flowing from his head and face. His face was crushed, mutilated, and disfigured. He was evidently badly injured.
"Merciful heaven!" wailed the coachman. "What more could I do? If I'd been driving fast or had not shouted to him, but I was going quietly, not in a hurry. Everyone could see I was going along just like everybody else. A drunken man can't walk straight, we all know. I saw him crossing the street, staggering and almost falling. I shouted again, and a second and a third time. Then I held the horses in, but he fell straight under their feet. Either he did it on purpose or he was very tipsy. The horses are young and ready to take fright. They started. He screamed. That made them worse. That's how it happened."
"That's just how it was," a voice in the crowd confirmed. "He shouted, that's true. He shouted 3 times. Another voice declared. 3 times it was, we all heard it," shouted a third.
But the coachman was not very much distressed and frightened. It was evident that the carriage belonged to a rich and important person who was awaiting it somewhere. The police, of course, were in no little anxiety to avoid upsetting his arrangements. All they had to do was to take the injured man to the police station and the hospital. No one knew his name. Meanwhile, Raskolnikov had squeezed in and stooped closer over him. The lantern suddenly lighted up the unfortunate man's face. He recognized him.
"I know him! I know him!"
he shouted, pushing to the front.
"It's a government clerk, retired from the service, Marmeladov. He lives close by in Kozel's house. Make haste for a doctor. I will pay. See?"
He pulled money out of his pocket and showed it to the policeman. He was in violent agitation. The police were glad that they had found out who the man was. Raskolnikov gave his own name and address, and as earnestly as if it had been his father, he besought the police to carry the unconscious Marmeladov to his lodging at once.
"Just here, 3 houses away," he said eagerly. "The house belongs to Kozel, a rich German. He was going home, no doubt, drunk. I know him. He is a drunkard. He has a family there, a wife, children. He has 1 daughter. It will take time to take him to the hospital, and there is sure to be a doctor in the house. I'll pay. I'll pay. At least he will be looked after at home. They will help him at once. But he'll die before you get him to the hospital."
He managed to slip something unseen into the policeman's hand. But the thing was straightforward and legitimate. And in any case, help was closer here. They raised the injured man. People volunteered to help. Kozel's house was 30 yards away. Raskolnikov walked behind, carefully holding Marmeladov's head and showing the way.
"This way, this way. We must take him upstairs, head foremost. Turn around. I'll pay. I'll make it worth your while," he muttered.
Katerina Ivanovna had just begun, as she always did at every free moment, walking to and fro in her little room from window to stove and back again, with her arms folded across her chest, talking to herself and coughing. Of late she had begun to talk more than ever to her eldest girl, Polyanka, a child of 10, who, though there was much she did not understand, understood very well that her mother needed her, and so always watched her with her big, clever eyes, and strove her utmost to appear to understand. This time Polyanka was undressing her little brother, who had been unwell all day and was going to bed. The boy was waiting for her to take off his shirt, which had to be washed at night. He was sitting straight and motionless on a chair, with a silent, serious face, with his legs stretched out straight before him, heels together and toes turned out. He was listening to what his mother was saying to his sister, sitting perfectly still with pouting lips and wide-open eyes, just as all good little boys have to sit when they are undressed to go to bed. A little girl, still younger, dressed literally in rags, stood at the screen waiting for her turn. The door onto the stairs was open, to relieve them a little from the clouds of tobacco smoke which floated in from the other rooms and brought on long, terrible fits of coughing in the poor, consumptive woman. Katerina Ivanovna seemed to have grown even thinner during that week, and the hectic flush on her face was brighter than ever. "You wouldn't believe, you can't imagine, Polyanka," she said, walking about the room, "what a happy, luxurious life we had in my papa's house.
and how this drunkard has brought me, and will bring you all, to ruin. Papa was a civil colonel, and only a step from being a governor. So that everyone who came to see him said, 'We look upon you, Ivan Mikhailovich, as our governor.' When—" She coughed violently. "Oh, cursed life," she cried, clearing her throat and pressing her hands to her breast. "When at the last ball, at the marshal's, Princess Byezemyelny saw me, who gave me the blessing when your father and I were married, Bolyanka. She asked at once, 'Isn't that the pretty girl who danced the shawl dance at the breaking up?' 'You must mend that tear. You must take your needle and darn it as I showed you, or tomorrow—' "'He will make the hole bigger,' she articulated with effort. Prince Szczygolskoy, a kammerjunker, had just come from Petersburg then. He danced the mazurka with me and wanted to make me an offer next day. But I thanked him in flattering expressions and told him that my heart had long been another's. That other was your father, Polya. Papa was fearfully angry. 'Is the water ready? Give me the shirt and the stockings. Lida,' said she to the youngest one, 'you must manage without your chemise tonight, and lay your stockings out with it. I'll wash them together. How is it that drunken vagabond doesn't come in? He has worn his shirt till it looks like a dishcloth. He has torn it to rags. I'll do it all together, so as not to have to work two nights running. Oh, dear! Again, what's this?' she cried, noticing a crowd in the passage. And the men, who were pushing into her room, carrying a burden. 'What is it? What are they bringing? Mercy on us!'
'Where are we to put him?' asked the policeman, looking round when Marmeladov, unconscious and covered with blood, had been carried in.
'On the sofa. Put him straight on the sofa, with his head this way,' Raskolnikov showed him.
'Run over in the road, drunk,' someone shouted in the passage.
Katerina Ivanovna stood, turning white and gasping for breath. The children were terrified. Little Lida screamed, rushed to Polyanka, and clutched at her, trembling all over. Having laid Marmeladov down, Raskolnikov flew to Katerina Ivanovna. 'For God's sake, be calm. Don't be frightened,' he said, speaking quickly. 'He was crossing the road and was run over by a carriage. Don't be frightened. He will come too. I told them to bring him here. I've been here already, you remember? He will come too. I'll pay.' 'He's done it this time,' Katerina Ivanovna cried despairingly, and she rushed to her husband. Raskolnikov noticed at once that she was not one of those women who swoon easily. She instantly placed under the luckless man's head a pillow, which no one had thought of, and began undressing and examining him. She kept her head, forgetting herself, biting her trembling lips and stifling the screams which were ready to break free from her. Raskolnikov, meanwhile, induced someone to run for a doctor. There was a doctor, it appeared, next door but one. 'I've sent for a doctor,' he kept assuring Katerina Ivanovna. 'Don't be uneasy. I'll pay. Haven't you water? And give me a napkin or a towel, anything, as quick as you can. He is injured but not killed, believe me. We shall see what the doctor says.' Katerina Ivanovna ran to the window. There, on a broken chair in the corner, a large earthenware basin full of water had been stood in readiness for washing her children's and husband's linen that night. This washing was done by Katerina Ivanovna at night at least twice a week, if not oftener. For the family had come to such a pass that they were practically without change of linen. And Katerina Ivanovna could not endure uncleanliness, and, rather than see dirt in the house, she preferred to wear herself out at night, working beyond her strength when the rest were asleep, so as to get the wet linen hung on a line and dry by the morning. She took up the basin of water at Raskolnikov's request, but almost fell down with her burden. But the latter had already succeeded in finding a towel, wetted it, and begun washing the blood off Marmeladov's face. Katerina Ivanovna stood by, breathing painfully and pressing her hands to her breast. She was in need of attention herself. Raskolnikov began to realize that he might have made a mistake in having the injured man brought here.
The policeman, too, stood in hesitation.
Polinka, cried Katerina Ivanovna, run to Sonya. Make haste. If you don't find her at home, leave word that her father has been run over and that she is to come here at once. When she comes in, run, Polinka. There, put on the shawl.
Run your fastest, cried the little boy on the chair suddenly.
After which he relapsed into the same dumb rigidity, with round eyes, his heels thrust forward and his toes spread out. Meanwhile, the room had become so full of people that you couldn't have dropped a pin. The policemen left, all except one who remained for a time, trying to drive out the people who came in from the stairs. Almost all Madame Lippevechsel's lodgers had streamed in from the inner rooms of the flat. At first they were squeezed together in the doorway, but afterwards they overflowed into the room. Katerina Ivanovna flew into a fury.
"You might let him die in peace, at least," she shouted at the crowd. "Is it a spectacle for you to gape at? With cigarettes? You might as well keep your hats on. And there is one in his hat. Get away. You should respect the dead, at least."
Her cough choked her, but her reproaches were not without result. They evidently stood in some awe of Katerina Ivanovna. The lodgers, one after another, squeezed back into the doorway with that strange inner feeling of satisfaction which may be observed in the presence of a sudden accident, even in those nearest and dearest to the victim, from which no living man is exempt, even in spite of the sincerest sympathy and compassion. Voices outside were heard, however, speaking of the hospital and saying that they'd no business to make a disturbance here.
"No business to die!"
cried Katerina Ivanovna. And she was rushing to the door to vent her wrath upon them, but in the doorway came, face to face, with Madame Lippevechsel, who had only just heard of the accident and ran in to restore order. She was a particularly quarrelsome and irresponsible German.
"Ah! My God," she cried, clasping her hands, "your husband, drunken horses have trampled. To the hospital with him. I am the landlady."
"Amalia Ludvigovna, I beg you to recollect what you are saying," Katerina Ivanovna began haughtily. She always took a haughty tone with the landlady, that she might remember her place, and even now could not deny herself this satisfaction. "Amalia Ludvigovna, I have you once before told that you to call me Amalia Ludvigovna may not dare. I am Amalia Ivanovna."
"You are not Amalia Ivanovna, but Amalia Ludvigovna. And as I am not one of your despicable flatterers like Mr. Lebezyatnikov, who's laughing behind the door at this moment,"
a laugh and a cry of "they are at it again" was, in fact, audible at the door,
"so I shall always call you Amalia Ludvigovna, though I fail to understand why you dislike that name. You can see for yourself what has happened to Semyon Zakharovich. He is dying. I beg you to close that door at once and to admit no one. Let him at least die in peace. Or I warn you, the Governor-General himself shall be informed of your conduct tomorrow. The Prince knew me as a girl. He remembers Semyon Zakharovich well and has often been a benefactor to him. Everyone knows that Semyon Zakharovich had many friends and protectors, whom he abandoned himself from an honorable pride, knowing his unhappy weakness. But now," she pointed to Raskolnikov, "a generous young man has come to our assistance, who has wealth and connections, and whom Semyon Zakharovich has known from a child. You may rest assured, Amalia Ludvigovna."
All this was uttered with extreme rapidity, getting quicker and quicker, but a cough suddenly cut short Katerina Ivanovna's eloquence. At that instant the dying man recovered consciousness and uttered a groan. She ran to him. The injured man opened his eyes, and without recognition or understanding, gazed at Raskolnikov, who was bending over him. He drew deep, slow, painful breaths. Blood oozed at the corners of his mouth, and drops of perspiration came out on his forehead. Not recognizing Raskolnikov, he began looking round uneasily. Katerina Ivanovna looked at him with a sad but stern face,
and tears trickled from her eyes. My God, his whole chest is crushed. How he is bleeding, she said in despair. We must take off his clothes. Turn a little, Semyon Zakharovich, if you can, she cried to him.
Marmeladov recognized her.
A priest, he articulated huskily.
Katerina Ivanovna walked to the window, laid her head against the window frame, and exclaimed in despair,
Oh, cursed life! A priest, the dying man said again after a moment's silence. They've gone for him,
Katerina Ivanovna shouted to him. He obeyed her shout and was silent. With sad and timid eyes he looked for her. She returned and stood by his pillow. He seemed a little easier, but not for long. Soon his eyes rested on little Lida, his favorite, who was shaking in the corner as though she were in a fit, and staring at him with her wondering, childish eyes.
Ah!
He signed towards her uneasily. He wanted to say something.
What now? Cried Katerina Ivanovna. Barefoot! Barefoot!
He muttered, indicating with frenzied eyes the child's bare feet.
Be silent!
Katerina Ivanovna cried irritably.
You know why she is barefooted. Thank God, the doctor! Exclaimed Raskolnikov, relieved.
The doctor came in, a precise little old man, a German, looking about him mistrustfully. He went up to the sick man, took his pulse, carefully felt his head, and with the help of Katerina Ivanovna he unbuttoned the blood-stained shirt and bared the injured man's chest.
It was gashed, crushed and fractured. Several ribs on the right side were broken. On the left side, just over the heart, was a large, sinister-looking, yellowish-black bruise, a cruel kick from the horse's hoof. The doctor frowned. The policeman told him that he was caught in the wheel and turned round with it for 30 yards on the road.
It's a miracle that he has recovered consciousness,
the doctor whispered softly to Raskolnikov. What do you think of him? He asked.
He will die immediately.
Is there really no hope?
Not the faintest. He is at the last gasp. His head is badly injured, too. I could bleed him if you like, but it would be useless. He is bound to die within the next 5 or 10 minutes.
Better bleed him, then.
If you like. But I warn you, it will be perfectly useless.
At that moment, other steps were heard. The crowd in the passage parted, and the priest, a little gray old man, appeared in the doorway bearing the sacrament. A policeman had gone for him at the time of the accident. The doctor changed places with him, exchanging glances with him. Raskolnikov begged the doctor to remain a little while. He shrugged his shoulders and remained. All stepped back. The confession was soon over. The dying man probably understood little. He could only utter indistinct, broken sounds. Katerina Ivanovna took little Lida, lifted the boy from the chair, knelt down in the corner by the stove and made the children kneel in front of her. The little girl was still trembling. But the boy, kneeling on his little bare knees, lifted his hand rhythmically, crossing himself with precision, and bowed down, touching the floor with his forehead, which seemed to afford him especial satisfaction. Katerina Ivanovna bit her lips and held back her tears. She prayed, too, now and then pulling straight the boy's shirt, and managed to cover the girl's bare shoulders with a kerchief, which she took from the chest without rising from her knees or ceasing to pray. Meanwhile, the door from the inner rooms was opened inquisitively again,
In the passage the crowd of spectators from all the flats on the staircase grew denser and denser, but they did not venture beyond the threshold. A single candle end lighted up the scene. At that moment, Polyanka forced her way through the crowd at the door. She came in panting from running so fast, took off her kerchief, looked for her mother, went up to her and said, "She's coming. I met her in the street." Her mother made her kneel beside her. Timidly and noiselessly, a young girl made her way through the crowd. And strange was her appearance in that room, in the midst of want, rags, death, and despair. She too was in rags. Her attire was all of the cheapest, but decked out in gutter finery of a special stamp, unmistakably betraying its shameful purpose. Sonya stopped short in the doorway and looked about her, bewildered, unconscious of everything. She forgot her fourth-hand gaudy silk dress, so unseemly here with its ridiculous long train, and her immense crinoline that filled up the whole doorway, and her light-colored shoes, and the parasol she brought with her, though it was no use at night, and the absurd round straw hat with its flaring flame-colored feather. Under this rakishly tilted hat was a pale, frightened little face, with lips parted and eyes staring in terror. Sonya was a small, thin girl of 18, with fair hair, rather pretty, with wonderful blue eyes. She looked intently at the bed and the priest. She too was out of breath with running. At last, whispers, some words in the crowd probably reached her. She looked down and took a step forward into the room, still keeping close to the door. The service was over. Katerina Ivanovna went up to her husband again. The priest stepped back and turned to say a few words of admonition and consolation to Katerina Ivanovna on leaving.
"What am I to do with these?"
she interrupted sharply and irritably, pointing to the little ones.
"God is merciful. Look to the Most High for succor,"
the priest began.
"Ach, he is merciful, but not to us."
"That's a sin, madam,"
observed the priest, shaking his head.
"And isn't that a sin?"
cried Katerina Ivanovna, pointing to the dying man.
"Perhaps those who have involuntarily caused the accident will agree to compensate you, at least for the loss of his earnings."
"You don't understand," cried Katerina Ivanovna, angrily waving her hand.
"And why should they compensate me? Why, he was drunk and threw himself under the horses. What earnings? He brought us in nothing but misery. He drank everything away, the drunkard. He robbed us to get drink. He wasted their lives and mine for drink. And thank God he's dying. One less to keep."
"You must forgive in the hour of death. That's a sin, madam. Such feelings are a great sin."
Katerina Ivanovna was busy with the dying man. She was giving him water, wiping the blood and sweat from his head, setting his pillow straight, and had only turned now and then for a moment to address the priest. Now she flew at him almost in a frenzy.
"Ah, father, that's words and only words. Forgive. If he'd not been run over, he'd have come home today drunk, and his only shirt dirty and in rags, and he'd have fallen asleep like a log, and I would have been sousing and rinsing till daybreak, washing his rags and the children's, and then drying them by the window, and as soon as it was daylight, I would have been darning them. That's how I spend my nights. What's the use of talking of forgiveness? I have forgiven as it is."
A terrible, hollow cough interrupted her words. She put her handkerchief to her lips and showed it to the priest, pressing her other hand to her aching chest. The handkerchief was covered with blood. The priest bowed his head and said nothing. Marmeladov was in the last agony. He didn't take his eyes off the face of Katerina Ivanovna, who was bending over him again.
He kept trying to say something to her. He began moving his tongue with difficulty and articulating indistinctly, but Katerina Ivanovna, understanding that he wanted to ask her forgiveness, called peremptorily to him, "Be silent. No need. I know what you want to say." And the sick man was silent. But at the same instant, his wandering eyes strayed to the doorway, and he saw Sonya. Till then he hadn't noticed her. She was standing in the shadow in a corner.
"Who's that? Who's that?"
he said suddenly in a thick, gasping voice, in agitation, turning his eyes in horror towards the door where his daughter was standing and trying to sit up. "Lie down, lie down!" cried Katerina Ivanovna. With unnatural strength, he had succeeded in propping himself on his elbow. He looked wildly and fixedly for some time on his daughter, as though not recognizing her. He had never seen her before in such attire. Suddenly he recognized her, crushed and ashamed in her humiliation and gaudy finery, meekly awaiting her turn to say good-bye to her dying father. His face showed intense suffering.
"Sonya, daughter, forgive,"
he cried, and he tried to hold out his hand to her. But losing his balance, he fell off the sofa, face downwards on the floor. They rushed to pick him up. They put him on the sofa. But he was dying. Sonya, with a faint cry, ran up, embraced him, and remained so without moving. He died in her arms.
"He's got what he wanted,"
Katerina Ivanovna cried, seeing her husband's dead body.
"Well, what's to be done now? How am I to bury him? What can I give them tomorrow to eat?"
Raskolnikov went up to Katerina Ivanovna. "Katerina Ivanovna," he began, "last week your husband told me all his life and circumstances. Believe me, he spoke of you with passionate reverence. From that evening when I learnt how devoted he was to you all, and how he loved and respected you especially, Katerina Ivanovna, in spite of his unfortunate weakness, from that evening we became friends. Allow me now to do something, to repay my debt to my dead friend. Here are 20 rubles, I think, and if that can be of any assistance to you, then I will come again. I will be sure to come again. I shall perhaps come again tomorrow. Goodbye." And he went quickly out of the room, squeezing his way through the crowd to the stairs. But in the crowd he suddenly jostled against Nikodim Fomitch, who had heard of the accident and had come to give instructions in person. They hadn't met since the scene at the police station, but Nikodim Fomitch knew him instantly.
"Ah, is that you?" he asked him.
"He's dead," answered Raskolnikov. "The doctor and the priest have been. All as it should have been. Don't worry the poor woman too much. She is in consumption as it is. Try and cheer her up, if possible. You are a kind-hearted man, I know," he added with a smile, looking straight in his face.
"But you are spattered with blood,"
observed Nikodim Fomitch, noticing in the lamplight some fresh stains on Raskolnikov's waistcoat. "Yes, I'm covered with blood," Raskolnikov said with a peculiar air. Then he smiled, nodded, and went downstairs. He walked down slowly and deliberately, feverish, but not conscious of it, entirely absorbed in a new, overwhelming sensation of life and strength that surged up suddenly within him. This sensation might be compared to that of a man condemned to death who has suddenly been pardoned. Halfway down the staircase he was overtaken by the priest on his way home. Raskolnikov let him pass, exchanging a silent greeting with him. He was just descending the last steps when he heard rapid footsteps behind him,
Someone overtook him. It was Polyanka. She was running after him, calling, "Wait, wait!" He turned round. She was at the bottom of the staircase and stopped short a step above him. A dim light came in from the yard. Raskolnikov could distinguish the child's thin but pretty little face, looking at him with a bright, childish smile. She had run after him with a message which she was evidently glad to give.
"Tell me, what is your name, and where do you live?" she said hurriedly, in a breathless voice.
He laid both hands on her shoulders and looked at her with a sort of rapture. It was such a joy to him to look at her. He couldn't have said why.
"Who sent you?" "Sister Sonya sent me," answered the girl, smiling still more brightly.
"I knew it was Sister Sonya sent you."
"Mama sent me too. When Sister Sonya was sending me, Mama came up too and said, 'Run fast, Polyanka.'"
"Do you love Sister Sonya?"
"I love her more than anyone," Polyanka
answered with a peculiar earnestness, and her smile became graver.
"And will you love me?"
By way of answer, he saw the little girl's face approaching him, her full lips naively held out to kiss him. Suddenly, her arms, as thin as sticks, held him tightly, her head rested on his shoulder, and the little girl wept softly, pressing her face against him.
"I am sorry for father," she said a moment later, raising her tear-stained face and brushing away the tears with her hands. "It's nothing but misfortunes now," she added suddenly, with that peculiarly sedate air which children try hard to assume when they want to speak like grown-up people.
"Did your father love you?"
"He loved Lida most,"
she went on very seriously, without a smile, exactly like grown-up people.
"He loved her because she is little and because she is ill, too. And he always used to bring her presents. But he taught us to read, and me grammar and scripture, too," she added with dignity. "And mother never used to say anything. But we knew that she liked it, and father knew it, too. And mother wants to teach me French, for it's time my education began."
"And do you know your prayers?"
"Of course we do. We knew them long ago. I say my prayers to myself, as I am a big girl now, but Kolya and Lida say them aloud with mother. First they repeat the Ave Maria, and then another prayer, 'Lord, forgive and bless Sister Sonya.' And then another, 'Lord, forgive and bless our second father.' For our elder father is dead, and this is another one, but we do pray for the other as well."
"Polyanka, my name is Rodion. Pray sometimes for me too. And thy servant Rodion, nothing more."
"I'll pray for you all the rest of my life,"
the little girl declared hotly. And suddenly, smiling again, she rushed at him and hugged him warmly once more. Raskolnikov told her his name and address, and promised to be sure to come next day. The child went away quite enchanted with him. It was past 10 when he came out into the street. In 5 minutes he was standing on the bridge, at the spot where the woman had jumped in.
"Enough," he pronounced resolutely and triumphantly. "I've done with fancies, imaginary terrors and phantoms. Life is real. Haven't I lived just now? My life has not yet died with that old woman. The kingdom of heaven to her. And now, enough, madam, leave me in peace. Now for the reign of reason and light, and of will, and of strength. And now we will see, we will try our strength," he added defiantly, as though challenging some power of darkness. "And I was ready to consent to live in a square of space. I am very weak at this moment, but I believe my illness is all over. I knew it would be over when I went out. By the way, Potchinkov's house is only a few steps away. I certainly must go to Razumihin, even if it were not close by. Let him win his bet."
Let us give him some satisfaction, too. No matter. Strength. Strength is what one wants. You can get nothing without it. And strength must be won by strength. That's what they don't know, he added proudly and self-confidently. And he walked with flagging footsteps from the bridge.
Pride and self-confidence grew continually stronger in him. He was becoming a different man every moment. What was it had happened to work this revolution in him? He didn't know himself. Like a man catching at a straw, he suddenly felt that he too could live, that there was still life for him, that his life had not died with the old woman. Perhaps he was in too great a hurry with his conclusion, but he didn't think of that.
But I did ask her to remember thy servant Rodion in her prayers, the idea struck him. Well, that was in case of emergency, he added, and laughed himself at his boyish sally. He was in the best of spirits. He easily found Razumihin. The new lodger was already known at Potchinkov's, and the porter at once showed him the way. Halfway upstairs he could hear the noise and animated conversation of a big gathering of people. The door was wide open on the stairs. He could hear exclamations and discussion. Razumihin's room was fairly large. The company consisted of 15 people. Raskolnikov stopped in the entry, where two of the landlady's servants were busy behind a screen with two samovars, bottles, plates, and dishes of pie and savouries brought up from the landlady's kitchen. Raskolnikov sent in for Razumihin. He ran out delighted. At the first glance it was apparent that he had had a great deal to drink, and, though no amount of liquor made Razumihin quite drunk, this time he was perceptibly affected by it. "Listen," Raskolnikov hastened to say, "I've only just come to tell you you've won your bet, and that no one really knows what may not happen to him. I can't come in. I am so weak that I shall fall down directly. And so, good evening and good-bye. Come and see me tomorrow."
"Do you know what? I'll see you home. If you say you're weak yourself, you must—"
"And your visitors? Who is the curly-headed one, who has just peeped out?"
"He? Goodness only knows. Some friend of Uncle's, I expect. Or perhaps he has come without being invited. I leave Uncle with them. He is an invaluable person. Pity I can't introduce you to him now. But confound them all now. They won't notice me. And I need a little fresh air, for you've come just in the nick of time. Another 2 minutes— and I should have come to blows. They're talking such a lot of wild stuff. You simply can't imagine what men will say. Though why shouldn't you imagine? Don't we talk nonsense ourselves? And let them. That's the way to learn not to. Wait a minute. I'll fetch Zosimov."
Zosimov pounced upon Raskolnikov almost greedily. He showed a special interest in him. Soon his face brightened.
"You must go to bed at once," he pronounced, examining the patient as far as he could. "And take something for the night. Will you take it?" "I got it ready some time ago. A powder."
"Two, if you like," answered Raskolnikov. The powder was taken at once.
"It's a good thing you are taking him home," observed Zosimov to Razumihin. "We shall see how he is tomorrow. Today he's not at all amiss. A considerable change since the afternoon. Live and learn."
"Do you know what Zosimov whispered to me when we were coming out?" Razumihin blurted out as soon as they were in the street.
"I won't tell you everything, brother, because they're such fools. Zosimov told me to talk freely to you on the way and get you to talk freely to me. And afterwards I am to tell him about it, for he's got a notion in his head that you are mad, or close on it. Only think, in the first place, you've three times the brains he has. In the second, if you are not mad, you needn't care a hang that he's got such a wild idea. And thirdly, that piece of beef whose specialty is surgery has gone mad on mental diseases. And what's brought him to this conclusion about you was your conversation today with Zamyatov."
"Zamyatov told you all about it?"
"Yes, and he did well.
Now I understand what it all means, and so does Zamyatov. Well, the fact is, Rodya, the point is, I am a little drunk now, but that's no matter. The point is that this idea, you understand, was just being hatched in their brains. You understand? That is, no one ventured to say it aloud, because the idea is too absurd, and especially since the arrest of that painter, that bubble's burst and gone forever. But why are they such fools? I gave Zamyatov a bit of a thrashing at the time. That's between ourselves, brother. Please don't let out a hint that you know of it. I've noticed he is a ticklish subject. It was at Luisa Ivanovna's. But today it's all cleared up. That Ilya Petrovich is at the bottom of it. He took advantage of your fainting at the police station, but he's ashamed of it himself now. I know that... Raskolnikov listened greedily. Razumihin was drunk enough to talk too freely. "I fainted then because it was so close, and the smell of paint," said Raskolnikov. "No need to explain that. And it wasn't the point, only. The fever had been coming on for a month. Zosimov testifies to that. But how crushed that boy is now, you wouldn't believe. 'I am not worth his little finger,' he says. Yours, he means. He has good feelings at times, brother. But the lesson you gave him today, in the Palais du Cristal, that was too good for anything. You frightened him at first, you know. He nearly went into convulsions. You almost convinced him again of the truth of all that hideous nonsense, and then you suddenly put out your tongue at him. There now, what do you make of it? It was perfect. He is crushed, annihilated now. It was masterly, by God. It's what they deserve. Ah, that I wasn't there. He was hoping to see you awfully. Porfiry, too, wants to make your acquaintance. Ah, he too. But why did they put me down as mad? Oh, not mad. I must have said too much, brother. What struck him, you see, was that only that subject seemed to interest you. Now it's clear why it did interest you, knowing all the circumstances, and how that irritated you and worked in with your illness. I'm a little drunk, brother. Only, confound him, he has some idea of his own. I tell you, he's mad on mental diseases, but don't you mind him." For half a minute both were silent. "Listen, Razumihin," began Raskolnikov. "I want to tell you plainly. I've just been at a deathbed, a clerk who died. I gave them all my money. And besides, I've just been kissed by someone who, if I killed anyone, would just the same. In fact, I saw someone else there with a flame-colored feather. But I'm talking nonsense. I'm very weak. Support me. We shall be at the stairs directly." "What's the matter? What's the matter with you?" Razumihin asked anxiously. "I'm a little giddy, but that's not the point. I am so sad. So sad. Like a woman. Look, what's that? Look, look. What is it? Don't you see? A light in my room, you see? Through the crack." They were already at the foot of the last flight of stairs, at the level of the landlady's door, and they could, as a fact, see from below that there was a light in Raskolnikov's garret. "Queer. Nastasya, perhaps," observed Razumihin. "She is never in my room at this time. And she must be in bed long ago, but... I don't care. Goodbye." "What do you mean? I'm coming with you. We'll come in together." "I know we are going in together, but I want to shake hands here and say goodbye to you here. So give me your hand. Goodbye." "What's the matter with you, Rodya?" "Nothing. Come along. You shall be witness." They began mounting the stairs, and the idea struck Razumihin that perhaps Zosimov might be right after all. "I've upset him with my chatter," he muttered to himself. When they reached the door, they heard voices in the room. "What is it?" cried Razumihin. Raskolnikov was the first to open the door. He flung it wide and stood still in the doorway, dumbfounded. His mother and sister were sitting on his sofa, and had been waiting an hour and a half for him.
Why had he never expected, never thought of them, though the news that they had started, were on their way and would arrive immediately, had been repeated to him only that day? They had spent that hour and a half plying Nastasya with questions. She was still standing before them, and had told them everything by now. They were beside themselves with alarm when they heard of his running away today, ill and, as they understood from her story, delirious. Good heavens, what had become of him? Both had been weeping, both had been in anguish for that hour and a half. A cry of joy, of ecstasy, greeted Raskolnikov's entrance. Both rushed to him. But he stood like one dead. A sudden intolerable sensation struck him like a thunderbolt. He didn't lift his arms to embrace them. He couldn't. His mother and sister clasped him in their arms, kissed him, laughed, and cried. He took a step, tottered, and fell to the ground, fainting. Anxiety, cries of horror, moans, Razumihin, who was standing in the doorway, flew into the room, seized the sick man in his strong arms, and in a moment had him on the sofa. "It's nothing, nothing," he cried to the mother and sister. "It's only a faint, a mere trifle. Only just now the doctor said he was much better, that he is perfectly well. Water, see, he's coming to himself. He's all right again." And seizing Dunya by the arm, so that he almost dislocated it, he made her bend down to see that he is all right again. The mother and sister looked on him with emotion and gratitude as their providence. They had heard already from Nastasya all that had been done for their Rodya during his illness by this very competent young man, as Pulcheria Alexandrovna Raskolnikov called him that evening, in conversation with Dunya.
Part 3 Chapter 1 Raskolnikov got up and sat down on the sofa. He waved his hand weakly to Razumihin to cut short the flow of warm and incoherent consolations he was addressing to his mother and sister, took them both by the hand, and for a minute or two gazed from one to the other without speaking. His mother was alarmed by his expression. It revealed an emotion agonizingly poignant, and at the same time something immovable, almost insane. Pulcheria Alexandrovna began to cry. Avdotya Romanovna was pale, her hand trembled in her brother's.
"Go home, with him," he said in a broken voice, pointing to Razumihin. "Goodbye till tomorrow. Tomorrow everything... Is it long since you arrived?"
"This evening, Rodya," answered Pulcheria Alexandrovna. "The train was awfully late. But, Rodya, nothing would induce me to leave you now. I will spend the night here near you."
"Don't torture me," he said with a gesture of irritation. "I will stay with him," cried Razumihin. "I won't leave him for a moment. Bother all my visitors. Let them rage to their heart's content. My uncle is presiding there."
How can I thank you?" Pulcheria Alexandrovna was beginning, once more pressing Razumihin's hands, but Raskolnikov interrupted her again.
"I can't have it. I can't have it," he repeated irritably. "Don't worry me. Enough. Go away. I can't stand it."
"Come, Mama. Come out of the room at least for a minute," Dunya whispered in dismay. "We are distressing him, that's evident."
"Mayn't I look at him after 3 years?"
wept Pulcheria Alexandrovna.
"Stay," he stopped them again. "You keep interrupting me, and my ideas get muddled. Have you seen Luzhin?"
"No, Rodya. But he knows already of our arrival. We have heard, Rodya, that Pyotr Petrovich was so kind as to visit you today," Pulcheria Alexandrovna added somewhat timidly.
"Yes, he was so kind. Dunya, I promised Luzhin I'd throw him downstairs and told him to go to hell."
"Rodya, what are you saying? Surely you don't mean to tell us—"
Pulcheria Alexandrovna began in alarm, but she stopped, looking at Dunya. Avdotya Romanovna was looking attentively at her brother, waiting for what would come next.
Both of them had heard of the quarrel from Nastasya. So far as she had succeeded in understanding and reporting it, and were in painful perplexity and suspense.
"Dunya,"
Raskolnikov continued with an effort, "I don't want that marriage. So at the first opportunity, tomorrow,